Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back, or welcome for the very first time. My name is Adriana Pajero, and this is my little brainchild of a podcast, Infectious, where we'll explore a new infectious disease or a topic related to infectious diseases each episode. This week, we'll be taking a sexy turn and relay the mystery and history of syphilis. Syphilis is probably best known as one of the many diseases that were mixed in with all the other lovely cooties we catch from bumping uglies, but actually has a complex, interesting, and unique history behind it that is often neglected due to the ease of the treatment of the illness today. In this episode, we'll cover everything from the bacteria itself, the poetic roots of the disease's name, why mercury saunas were ever a thing, and a ton of other good stuff. So buckle up, open up your ear holes, and get ready for episode 2, Syphilis. So, starting from the beginning, let's answer the question, what even is syphilis? And don't worry, I got you. Syphilis is a sexually transmitted infection, more commonly known as an STI, that results following the infection of a human, the only known natural host, with Treponema pallidum, a bacterium classified under the Spirochetes phylum. The bacterial class Spirochetes gained its name from the combination of the Greek word spira, to mean a coil, and keti, to mean hair, and represents the phylum of bacteria that is distinctively long and helically coiled like a corkscrew. Syphilis, though, isn't the only human treponema disease, as yaws, pinta, and bagel can also cause disease and are looped into some of the origin stories of syphilis itself. These three additional diseases are most commonly known as endemic syphilis in the region of the world where they are found, and are all caused by a unique subspecies of Treponema pallidum. Interestingly, while yaws and pinta primarily result in skin lesions, bagel is best known for its ability to affect the mucous membranes of the mouth, thin skins, and bones. Finally, while syphilis is an STI, its closest relatives tend to cause disease in young children and in warm, dry, and tropical locations of the world. Interestingly, apparently among all these organisms, their final form is largely driven by where infection occurred. Syphilis has been known to cause lesions on the hands of dentists who cared for infectious patients, and some cases, although rare, of bagel have been shown to occur on the body rather than on the mouth. Therefore, it appears that this entire class of infections are incredibly flexible and capable to infect the human body in a multitude of ways. But I digress. We'll return to our main hero. Villain? Let's go with main villain at this point in time. And just to finish off our intro, you might wonder to yourself, syphilis doesn't sound anything like treponema, so where the heck did the name even come from? Well, the story of the name is kind of wrapped up with the first outbreak, which I'll cover in a little bit later. But quickly, between the time that syphilis arose in 1493 to the early 1500s, the disease was commonly referred to as the French disease in Italy, the Italian disease in France, and basically the disease of your enemy everywhere else. But in 1530, that changed when Italian poet and medical personality Girolamo Francastoro completed his epic poem, Syphilis, Sive Mobus Gallicus, or Syphilis, or the French disease. And guess what? In the poem, syphilis wasn't the name of the disease at all. Oh, no, no, no. It was the main character. The main context of the story was that the protagonist, a shepherd named Syphilis, one day angered the Greek god of the sun, who also happens to be the Greek god of healing and disease, after he used all the water. And rather than apologizing like a good little shepherd, Syphilis instead was all like,
"Hey, buddy, shove it. I'm not going to pray to you anymore."
And Apollo wasn't happy. So he cursed him with, quote-unquote, a hideous disease named syphilis after the shepherd's name. And this shepherd was apparently mighty busy because he spread it to everyone in the kingdom, including the king. Sounds like a fun place to live, eh? But yes, to summarize, following the printing of this poem, the name of the disease in the literature quickly changed, and that is how the disease, syphilis, actually received its name. Moving forward, we're going to talk a little bit about how the disease is transmitted. As I mentioned earlier, the syphilis that we know and love...
I hate you.
is generally thought of as a sexually transmitted infection, although transmission can occur at any point through direct contact with a syphilitic sore, also known as a canker. These cankers can occur in or around the mouth, the external genitalia, inside the vagina, the anus, or in the rectum of those who are infected. Therefore, transmission can occur through a series of events that would allow an uninfected individual to come into contact with any of these areas. This would include childbirth and sex in all of its forms. As well, though, treponemal bacteria have also been seen to actually transfer across the placenta itself to infect the fetus. So contact with an external sore is not necessary for vertical transmission from mother to child. It is important to note, though, that other routes of transmission, such as kissing and needle sharing, are exceptionally rare. What is very cool, though, is how common this transmission is. Individuals with primary, secondary, and early latent stages, and no worries, I'll cover these in just a little bit, are all considered to be infectious, with official numbers from the Public Health Agency of Canada estimating that the risk of transmission per partner was between 9 to 64%. As well, though, transmission from mother to child occurs in 70 to 100% of untreated pregnant individuals with primary or secondary syphilis and 40% with early or latent syphilis. As you can imagine from these numbers, a single infectious case can quickly spread the disease to many others dependent on their level of sexual activity, and therefore, this can make the disease extremely infectious. You may ask, though, what exactly happens when I contract syphilis? If I happen to be one of the people who do. Well, syphilis, like many diseases, has multiple stages and has a diverse and wide array of manifestations that differ depending on the stage of the infection. For this reason, historically, syphilis has been referred to as the great impersonator, as many of its symptoms largely resemble other diseases, and one syphilis case will rarely perfectly resemble another. Nonetheless, syphilis has four distinct stages. This includes primary syphilis, secondary syphilis, latent syphilis, and, for the very unfortunate few, tertiary syphilis. Infection begins when T. pallidum enters the host's body through scratches or cuts on the surface of the skin or an intact mucous membrane. And if you don't know what mucous membranes are, don't worry, I didn't either. Mucous membranes include the mouth, nose, eyelids, vagina, urethral opening, and anus. Studies have been done to identify exactly how many bacteria are needed, and it has been found that the dose that will cause disease in about 50% of individuals is only 57 bacteria.
So tiny!
Although, of course, larger doses will result in a more rapid disease progression. I did a very quick literature search on this, predominantly out of my own interest, to see if, you know, shaving down there appears to alter infection rates, because, as we all know, when you shave, you cause microcuts, and yada yada yada. Apparently, though, this is just quite a well-shared myth. While there is some information collected through internet surveys that suggests there was an increased risk amongst women who more aggressively groom themselves, more recent papers with improved methods, such as the 2019 publication by Lester et al. Titled The Association Between Pubic Hair Grooming and Prevalent Sexually Transmitted Infection Among Female University Students, found there to be no increased rate of STI acquisition among college women with varying levels of grooming after adjustment for the number of sexual partners. Also, a super fun little piece of knowledge. Apparently, in this field, they classify people who go bare down there as extreme groomers. And this just gave me this image of a happy little bald vagina happily going skydiving or jumping through fiery hoops. Anyways, back to syphilis. Primary syphilis begins about 3 weeks after infection and is the first stage of the disease. It's characterized by the development of a painless canker where the bacteria entered the body and swelling of the regional lymph nodes. This canker usually just looks like a single red papule.
Think a pimple.
Which gradually erodes over time and leaves a painless, clean ulcer with a smooth but raised border. The fluid, though, within the papule is filled with bacteria, and when it bursts, releases more T. pallidum into the surrounding environment, one of the many ways that the disease can spread to the next partner. This initial lesion can be between a few millimeters to several centimeters in length, although larger lesions are much more common in those who are immunocompromised, such as those who are infected with HIV. Speaking of these cankers, the most common location they develop is highly dependent on the activity the disease was contracted by, and therefore commonly aligns with sexual orientation. For example, heterosexual men will normally present with the lesion on their penis, while approximately one-third of men who participate in same-sex partnerships will present with a primary canker in another site, such as the rectum, anal canal, or oral cavity. As well, women are most likely to present with a canker on their labia, but it can also be shown on their cervix or the inner walls of their vagina as well. For these reasons, and because the canker itself is normally the first indication for many to seek treatment, women and men who have sex with men are more likely to not seek treatment during the primary stage of infection due to actually not even being able to see and detect that canker. After 2 to 6 weeks, though, this initial lesion will heal, which can often promote the feeling of well-being for those who were infected. Similarly to that big pimple that's growing in between your eyebrows, when it's finally healed, you think the problem is gone. But don't write off syphilis that quickly. It may have disappeared, but now it's just lurking in the shadows. I mean, in the host's body. Dividing and conquering. While the development of the canker symbolizes the successful entrance of T. pallidum into the bloodstream, your genitals having a bad skin day is barely the start of the illness. During the time between primary and secondary disease, T. pallidum enters the lymphatic system or bloodstream and takes these superhighways through the body, leading to syphilis quickly transitioning from an acute to a systemic disease. Quick aside, you might be asking, what the hell is a lymphatic system, Pyero? And I have your back. Your lymphatic system could best be described as if your circulatory system and immune system had a baby. So similarly to your circulatory system, it is going to move fluid through the body, but rather than being driven by the heart, will be driven by the contraction of skeletal muscles. And secondarily, it is home to your lymph nodes, those pesky things that really swell up around your neck when you get sick, and there's a few other around your body. And all these little pipes act to bring the excess fluid that your body leaves behind back all the way up to your subclavian veins, the ones that are near your neck, where they drain back into your bloodstream. So by entering the lymphatic system, syphilis can quickly make it into the bloodstream and begin its spread. During the stage of infection, T. pallidum spreads to all organ systems and then lies in wait for about 3 months until it pops back up, like annoying black hair on your chin.
Hello?
This time, the symptoms are more generalized, though. This can include sore throat, muscle aches, malaise, weight loss, and general inflammation of the lymph nodes. Probably one of the many reasons that syphilis is known as the great imitator, as just think right now of how many diseases these symptoms could describe. As well, though, more specific manifestations of the infection exist. These include the development of pale and discrete macular lesions on the torso, hands, and feet, which are normally symmetrical. And when you think of a macular lesion, you can think of a pale, flat, and somewhat elliptical rash that's about 4 to 8 millimeters in size, which is light pink in lighter skin tones and violaceous in dark-skinned individuals. These macular regions are often followed by macular papular lesions in 60 to 70% of patients. And if those words mean nothing to you, macules are flat red splotches and papules are solid raised lesions. In rare circumstances, these secondary lesions can become necrotic, a condition called Lewy's maligna, but more often than not, they are inconspicuous and go largely unnoticed. Other rash-like or odd manifestations can occur, though. This can include alopecia of the scalp or even body hair due to infection of the hair follicle, or one of my favorites, commonly referred to as the crown of Venus. Individuals with secondary syphilis may develop a crown of small papules across their hairline. This manifestation received its name as Venus, the Roman goddess of love, was believed to be quite promiscuous. But there's more! So another type of secondary lesion can also arise in about 1 to 10 patients known as condylomata lata, which appear as cauliflower-like growths of the skin. These lesions are large in size and often appear in warm and moist areas, including the perineum and anus, and are highly, highly infectious. As well, localized inflammation in the mouth or the tongue and around the mucous membranes of the genitalia can cause these things called mucus patches. And okay, these are kind of hard to describe, but one of the best examples that I found was the inside of someone's mouth. And if you look inside, you can see these giant glossy white patches of skin, which look really weird, but definitely worth searching up. See, though, syphilis manifests as much more than a series of horrible skin rashes. As you might remember, I did mention that T. pallidum quickly enters and infiltrates many organs upon entry into the bloodstream. These resulting infections and inflammation of the body systems can result in gastric, renal, and hepatic, that's your liver, involvement. But even more scary, T. pallidum can infiltrate your brain. Neurosyphilis, the name given to the classical neurological complications of syphilis, have normally been associated with the tertiary stage of infection, but studies have demonstrated that T. pallidum can infiltrate the nervous system at a much earlier stage of the infection. Oh, and this isn't even rare by any means.
Uh-oh.
About 40% of early syphilis patients and 25% of individuals with latent syphilis experience some of these neurological symptoms. Symptoms of neurosyphilis can include those we normally think of as being associated with meningitis, including fever, headache, nausea, vomiting, and a stiff neck. Also, due to inflammation of the cranial nerves, those infected may also have blurred vision and photophobia, hearing loss, facial weakness. Inflammation of the eyes and numbness and pain of the arm and legs may also occur. Rarely, individuals with early syphilis may also experience memory loss and mental confusion. After the secondary stage, syphilis will enter the latent stage of infection, which begins after the symptoms of secondary syphilis spontaneously resolve once again after 3 months. Latent syphilis is split into two different stages: early latent syphilis, the first year after resolution of secondary symptoms, and late latent syphilis, which is anyone who makes it after that first year without developing symptoms again. Oh, and just so you know, of people who are in that first stage of early latent syphilis, about 25% will have a recurrent secondary manifestation. But once people make it past that first year, individuals will show to be serologically positive for syphilis, so if they get a blood test, but are very unlikely to transmit to others. And I just want to stress that although it is unlikely for the infection to be passed to a sexual partner, that does not mean that the syphilis organism is gone. Quote, organisms may seed the bloodstream intermittently during latent syphilis and can infect the developing fetus during pregnancy. Therefore, although unlikely, transmission is possible from any individual infected with the bacteria. Latent syphilis will continue onwards into perpetuum until curative treatments occur. But what happens if the case doesn't enter a stage of latency? And the answer is tertiary syphilis. So, if a patient doesn't enter into a stage of latency, the individual will continue to progress into the final stage of the illness, known as tertiary syphilis. Tertiary syphilis is exceptionally rare today, as most individuals are diagnosed and cured in their primary or secondary stages. We do have knowledge of these manifestations in the modern era, though, informed by the historic Oslo and Tuskegee studies. In the Oslo study, a retrospective study focused on the pre-antibiotic era, approximately 1 in 3 individuals with latent syphilis infections developed clinical manifestations of tertiary syphilis, but this was normally 20 to 40 years after the initial onset of infection. As well, the Tuskegee study, a study that ran from 1932 to 1972 that enrolled 408 African-American men in Macon County, Alabama, was observed prospectively. And well, I feel like the study itself deserves its own episode to provide a full overview of the ethical and racial issues surrounding it. But the individuals who were described in the study, 1, did not provide informed consent, and 2, did not receive treatment when syphilis therapy became available in the early 1950s, which could have prevented their mortality and morbidity. And yes, this is still an extremely controversial study to this day. But alas, what are the symptoms of tertiary syphilis? Well, this one is absolutely nasty and is likely the images you have seen if you Google worst case of syphilis. They include gammas, cardiovascular syphilis, and late neurological complications. Gamma, also known as granulomatous nodular lesions with variable central cell death, may develop as early as 2 years after initial infection, although they usually appear much later. And for those who don't know what the hell granulomatous nodular lesions might remotely mean, these are slowly progressing, painless, dull red patches on the skin that slowly break down into ulcers with a dark brown floor. And these, although normally found on the skin and bones, and yes, I said bones, historians use these to say if people had syphilis in the past, can also occur in the liver, heart, brain, stomach, and upper respiratory tract. These lesions rarely heal spontaneously, but resolve rapidly after being treated with antibiotic therapy. Unless affecting a critical organ, gammas often do not cause serious complications, thus they are termed as late benign syphilis. Prior to the advent of antibiotics, most deaths related to syphilis actually involved the heart. Typically, syphilitic aortitis, involving the ascending aorta, the largest blood vessel that the heart feeds into while it pumps, would have complications in about 10% of untreated individuals, resulting in aortic regurgitation. And no, that isn't puking out of your aorta, but rather means that the valves in your heart that make sure blood flows in the right direction are leaky, so the patient experiences reduced blood flow. Other complications can include coronary osteostenosis, narrowing of the blood vessels that deliver blood to your heart itself, which can increase risk of heart attacks, and saccular aneurysms, the most common type of brain aneurysm, named because they have a nice little round pocket that looks like a cranberry of death. Within 5 to 10 years of initial infection, early invasions of the central nervous system will also occur, resulting in the development of meningovascular syphilis in 2/5 of cases with neurosyphilis. Due to the increased inflammation in the arteries and capillaries that supply blood to the central nervous system, strokes become more common, which can lead to additional neurological challenges, such as dysphagia, higher cognitive deficits, motor deficits, seizures, and general behavioral and social issues. Another manifestation, known as parenchymal syphilis, is known for its combination of symptoms such as tabes dorsalis, or the slow degeneration of nerve cells and nerve fibers that carry sensory information to the brain. In this case, individuals may experience personality changes, emotional instability, memory impairment, hallucinations, and hyperactive reflexes. As this involves the spinal cord's posterior column and dorsal root ganglia, where your sensory nerve fibers enter your nervous system to transmit all of those heat and touch sensations up into your brain, individuals can experience sensory ataxia in their legs and feet. Paresthesia, or the tingling, prickling, chilling, burning sensation you get when you bang your funny bone, and sudden onset vomiting or abdominal pain. As well, they will often have a wide-based gait due to the loss of position and vibratory senses. They can lose the ability to sense temperature and deep pain sensations, which can also cause trophic lesions. So what exactly are trophic lesions? Well, trophic lesions are ulcers that are caused by external trauma to a part of the body that is in poor condition because of these diseases, which can include the loss of nerve fibers. These are one of the many reasons that individuals with diabetes often must receive amputations, as the loss of sense of temperature and deep pain sensations increase the risk of injury to the body and the development of gangrene without the person even noticing. And after quite a long segment, that's just about it for adult syphilis. But before we can leave this section of the podcast, we have to talk about the last group of syphilis's victims, babies. And more specifically, focus on congenital syphilis. Congenital syphilis, the transmission of T. pallidum from mother to child, occurs due to the presence of T. pallidum in the mother's bloodstream. During pregnancy, the bacteria will cross the placental barrier and enter the fetus. Interestingly, if the mother is treated in the first or second trimester, this seems to be protective. As well, if the mother is in latent syphilis, it also seems to be much rarer. But damn, when it enters, it is destructive. Fetal infections can result in spontaneous abortion or stillbirth, and in the circumstances where a baby is born, they are usually prematurely delivered, leading to lower birth weight even compared to other children with the same gestational age. As well, almost 1 in 20 of these babies will die soon after delivery due to pulmonary hemorrhage, the bacterial infection, or lack of liver function. Similarly to adults, syphilis in these children has multiple stages. These are generally divided into early congenital syphilis in the first 2 years of life, late manifestations after 2 years, and the residual stigmata. Early manifestations resemble severe symptoms of adult secondary syphilis and are usually apparent only 2 to 10 weeks after delivery. One of these symptoms, which is most commonly referred to as snuffles, but is nothing like the adorable pet rabbit your baby cousin named. Rather, invasion of T. pallidum into the nasal mucosa results in the persistent inflammation of the nose and a whitish discharge that is often tinged with blood. While this is happening, the T. pallidum often invades the cartilage of the nose and palate, which can result in a gametous destruction later in life. As well, they will have skin lesions that resemble adult lesions that are often accompanied by peeling of the skin on their palms and soles of their feet,
mucus patches, and condylomatolata.
Even if treated, late manifestations are common. These can include damage to the cornea and iris and even deafness. As well, swelling of the knees and elbows, eating away of the palate and nasal septum, and the development of peg-shaped notched upper incisors are also common. Other tooth deformities, saddle nose, and saber shins, which is the growth of curved shin bones, may also occur. So that's the general answer to the question, what does an infection with syphilis generally look like? As you can tell, though, there's a million different clinical presentations, which is one reason that syphilis had such an incredible importance to the medicine during the time that the disease had a higher prevalence. This has been emphasized many times over, but one clear example can be taken from a speech given by Dr. William Osler as he addressed the New York Academy of Medicine in 1897. I often tell my students that syphilis is the only disease which they require to know thoroughly. Know syphilis in all its manifestations and relations, and all other things clinical will be added on to you. So now that we have an overview of what causes syphilis, how it's transmitted, and what it looks like today, let's deep dive into the history of the infection. The first known syphilis outbreak in historical records occurred in Napoli, Italy, at the end of 1495. Initially, the plague broke out among the army of Charles VIII after the French king successfully invaded Napoli with his army of 50,000 troops that were primarily mercenaries harrying from across Europe, including those of Spanish, Flemish, Gascon, Swiss, and Italian descent. Oh, and their 800-person camp that included medical attendants, cooks, and, well, sex workers. Hint, hint about how syphilis spread throughout the army. Quickly after their victory, which was followed by a long period of indulgence, celebration, and debauchery, those in the city began to notice that the army had become afflicted by some terrible disease. Here, I just want to note that there is a strong consensus in the literature that the strain of syphilis which caused this first epidemic was more severe than that which affects individuals today, and was more likely to cause extreme morbidity and mortality among those who were inflicted by the illness. By those who contracted the illness. These records indicate that individuals who contracted syphilis would first become aware after the discovery of genital ulcers, similar to the disease today. But following this identification, the disease would progress to a fever, general rash, then weeks or months later would be followed by large, painful, and foul-smelling abscesses and sores across the body. And weirdly enough, during the night, these individuals would become afflicted with additional muscle and bone pain. As time passed, this strain of syphilis would continue to infiltrate those who were infected. The sores would slowly develop into deeper and deeper ulcers until they began to eat into the bones. Many individuals would have their noses, lips, and eyes eaten away as the gummas extended deeper into their flesh, infiltrating their mouth and throat, sometimes leading to an early death. In addition to these extreme symptoms, these records also detail that the disease was likely more transmissible than the strains that we see today, although this is largely attributed to the absence of an underlying immunity in the population due to its recent arrival. Unfortunately for Europe, but thankfully for syphilis's newfound career as the most horrific disease in history, the victory of the French in Napoli was short-lived. During the Battle of Ferrova at Amelia, Charles and his army were quickly forced to retreat back to France.
I need to fall back at once!
With many historians suggesting that the cause of this loss was that many of the troops had suddenly come down with this great sickness. Upon their loss, the army quickly dissolved, with the men splitting off from their camps to all the corners of Europe. As Voltaire wrote in his recollections of the outcomes of this battle, on their flippant way through Italy, the French carelessly picked up Genoa, Naples, and syphilis. Then they were thrown out and deprived of Napoli and Genoa, but they did not lose everything. Syphilis went with them. Syphilis had traveled further across Europe than a 19-year-old taking a gap year. It had spread to all the corners of the subcontinent, such an extensive new territory that the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian I proclaimed that nothing like this disease had ever been seen before, and that it must be a punishment of God for blasphemy. This may in part be when syphilis began to be seen as punishment from God for sin. But honestly, what wasn't a punishment from God back in the Renaissance? But anyways, the disease moved swiftly across Europe, and he spread fast. By 1500, only 7 years after the initial outbreak, there were cases within all of Scandinavia, Russia, Hungary, Greece, and Poland. But just to make it even better, this was a time of many European conquests around the world, and with them, they carried syphilis. On its first class, or maybe like fourth class, traveling was brutal during this time period. T. pallidum was carried around the world, landing in Calcutta in 1498 and expanding to Oceania, Africa, and the Near East, China, and Japan by 1520. But at this point in time, you may ask, if this disease had never been seen in Europe before this time, as Maximilian I proclaimed, where exactly did it come from? The fact that syphilis is, well, syphilis, an exceptionally stigmatized sexually transmitted disease, has added to the controversy over its origins. People often seem to want to blame it on every other country possible. Currently, though, there are three dominant hypotheses on the evolution of the Treponema pallidum species that causes syphilis: the Columbian, the pre-Columbian, and the Unitarian hypothesis. The Columbian theory, which originated in the 1500s, presents the narrative that a small group of sailors led by Christopher Columbus himself brought the disease back to Europe upon his return to Spain in March of 1493. This story carries the narrative that the illness came from the Old World, carried across the sea like a horrible Pandora's box within the loins and bodies of the small population of sailors.
Ahoy!
This hypothesis was generally supported by many factors, including the rapid spread of syphilis in what is argued to reflect the rampant spread of a novel infection through a virgin population. This hypothesis has also been supported by genetic analyses that have demonstrated that syphilis's great-grandparents were present on the continents of North and South America for long periods of time prior to the 1495 pandemic. The second theory, known as the pre-Columbian hypothesis, argues that syphilis had been present on the European subcontinent for many millennia, but due to the, one, presence of many other disorders that had similar characteristics, was misclassified prior to the Napoli outbreak, and two, a new strain that had undergone some level of mutation that increased its virulence resulted in the exceptional epidemic that followed. Finally, the Unitarian hypothesis suggests that treponematoses are environmentally determined expressions of a single but flexible disease, which treponemal pallidum is. As I mentioned before, there are multiple ways this illness expresses itself around the globe, and this seems to be regionally specific based on the practices of the people. In this theory, due to the improved hygiene and increased clothing necessary in Europe, skin-to-skin transmission of the endemic treponematosis, in addition to the lax urban sexual mixing, resulted in the evolution of the illness. Of note, though, this has been definitively disproven by genetic analyses. We know today that yaws and bejel and syphilis all are quite genetically distinct. So, out of these three theories, which one is right? Well, that can only be figured out by some good old-fashioned grave robbing and examination. So, anthropologists have rolled up their sleeves and done most of the dirty work. These investigations, though, are greatly limited by the high similarity of treponemal syndrome's manifestations. Their lesions are super, super similar. And moreover, that the skeletal evidence for treponemal diseases is extremely similar to those of other diseases. In short, your bones only change in three ways when you get sick. They can be absorbed by your body, they can grow, and they can grow to form abnormal lesions. Therefore, two diseases may both cause the bones to thin and be reabsorbed, but that doesn't mean that they're the same thing anthropologically. So, in conclusion, scientists' hands were bound. We can definitively say that there was a treponemal disease before Columbus, but can't say it was syphilis. Oh, and last but not least, remember,
Bones only get affected in the tertiary stage, so only people who died with the late stage of illness would be able to be identified by anthropologists. Okay, but what have we been able to find? First of all, as this has basically zero controversy, there is definitive evidence of treponemal disease in the Americas prior to 1943. So check, this suggests there could be a possibility of a transmission event, but what about in Europe? Well, some researchers suggested, this was in quite a controversial documentary, that there were over 50 skeletons from Europe dating back from the pre-Columbian era that apparently showed the lesions of chronic syphilis. These skeletons have often been quoted in popular debate to support this hypothesis, but investigations by Armelagos and his colleagues properly investigated these reports and found that most of the skeletal material didn't meet at least one of the standards of diagnostic criteria for chronic syphilis. So that means that they didn't have the pitting of the skull known as kerysika and pitting and swelling of the long bones. Interestingly, as well, the 16 skeletons that did meet the criteria for syphilis came from a coastal region where seafood was a large part of their diet. And this is really cool. As seafood contains a form of old carbon from the deep upwelling ocean waters, it therefore results in a marine reservoir effect that can throw off radiocarbon dating for skeletons. Therefore, this can throw off the radiocarbon dating of a skeleton by hundreds or even thousands of years. To adjust for this effect, a researcher would have to estimate approximately the amount of seafood that an individual consumed, which is based on the process where bones' consistencies are broken down and rebuilt within our lives. So you can kind of look into bone collagen protein and get a seamless record of what someone consumed throughout their life. After this adjustment for the high concentration of fish in these individuals, the skeletons that had a definitive sign of treponemal disease were clearly dated to be after Columbus's return to Europe. So, conclusion? It's unlikely that there was a treponemal disease in Europe prior to 1493, which suggests that there was transmission of some form of illness between the continents. But we don't know if that transmission was syphilis itself, or if it was a form of treponemal disease from the Americas that mutated during the journey or during the years between the voyage landing in 1943 to the first syphilis outbreak in 1945. The most recent sequencing data suggests that yes, it is likely that the source of the treponemal disease in Europe was the Americas, but the form is yet to be determined and possibly never will be. Or will it? So, surprise twist ending. In 2008, a new hypothesis was presented based on the findings from a team at Emory University, who published a genetic analysis of treponemal bacteria. The bacterial strain that causes this sexually transmitted disease known as syphilis was found to be relatively new in human history, but most closely related to the strains that cause yaws in South America. Based on this analysis, they offered a third theory for syphilis's origins and eventual global spread. It is not clear whether venereal syphilis existed in the New World prior to Columbus's arrival. They wrote, "While it is possible that Columbus and his crew imported venereal syphilis from the New World to Europe, it is also possible that the explorers imported a non-venereal progenitor that rapidly evolved into the pathogen who we know today only after it was introduced into the Old World." This new hypothesis is known as the modified Columbian hypothesis, as it has been tweaked to account for the genetic evidence. So, pretty cool. In the end of the day, it actually looks like it seems to be a combination of both. There was some level of transmission between the two different continents, and then eventually a mutation that resulted in it becoming potentially a sexually transmitted disease or much more virulent. So, super cool. Anyways, back to syphilis's history, because he's been around for a while and has literally been in everyone's pants. Moving forward into the 16th to 17th century, historians and physicians began to understand how the infection was spread, and in the early 1500s, literature on how the disease spread and its characteristics began to be published. One of these first records, written by Giovanni di Vigio, the surgeon to Pope Julius, in his book titled De Morbo Gallicus in 1514, which means the French disease. The contagion which gives rise to it comes particularly from coitus, that is, sexual commerce of a healthy man with a sick woman, or to the contrary. The first symptoms of this malady appear almost invariably upon the genital organs, that is, upon the penis or the vulva. They consist of small, ulcerated pimples of a color especially brownish and livid, sometimes black, sometimes light, slightly pale. These pimples are circumscribed by a ridge or callus-like hardness. Then there appear a series of new ulcerations on the genitalia. Then the skin becomes covered with scabby pimples or with elevated papules resembling warts. A month and a half, about, after the appearance of the first symptoms, of the patients are afflicted with pains sufficiently to draw from them cries of anguish. Still, very much later, a year or even longer after the above complications, there appear certain tumors of scurrous hardness which provoke terrible suffering. So as you can tell, the syphilis had many similarities to the symptoms I described earlier, but also many, many differences. Also, as a fun fact, in 1527, Jacques de Béthencourt coined the term venereal disease, as since the diseases arise from illicit love, it should be called the malady of Venus, or venereal disease. A fun little touch, as Venus was the goddess of love, sex, beauty, and fertility in Roman mythology, so definitely keep that in your back pocket for when you finally make it onto Jeopardy. You're welcome. Anyways, by this time, the European authorities were having none of this new disease, and became extremely concerned about how devastating it was to their population. So control measures were put into place, and these were largely focused on controlling sex workers and reducing sexual encounters outside of marriage. For example, Henry VIII of England tried to close down all the stews or brothels and communal bathhouses of London, which makes me have two major questions. Why were brothels called stews? And how fun were communal bathhouses? Back on topic. In the surrounding countryside, strict regulations were issued for brothels and bathhouses alike, forcing prostitutes who had diseases or infections out of employment and making mixed bathing largely prohibited across England. But even with these early prevention strategies, syphilis continued to march across Europe, with today's experts estimating that over 1 million people were infected in Europe, a ridiculously high prevalence, as currently estimates by some of the best historians put there to be only around 70.2 million people living on the continent in the 1550s. This means that the prevalence was around 14 per thousand persons, a threatening statistic, noting that there was no known remedy for the illness at the time. The mode of transmission for syphilis, as it is today, did bring much controversy on how those who were infected should be treated. 16th and 17th century writers and physicians were divided on the moral aspects of syphilis and if there should be repercussions shared to the patient following their diagnosis. Some thought it was a divine punishment for sin, and as such, only harsh treatments would cure it, or that people with syphilis shouldn't be treated at all. In 1673, Thomas Sydenham, a British physician, wrote an opposing view that the moral aspects of syphilis was not the province of the physician, who should treat all people without judgment. And these thoughts and feelings are something that continue forward to this day. Physicians in some areas believe they have a moral obligation to uphold their religious values when providing care and will refuse people abortions. Simultaneously, during the AIDS epidemic, due to the characteristics of the population that were infected, specifically gay and homosexual men, they weren't provided the same treatment that they potentially would have gotten if they were from a less marginalized group. So even to this day, we're left to ask the question, what's the role of a physician to judge their patients? But bringing ourselves back to syphilis, there was additional controversies that this disease brought up. As syphilis was largely transmitted through intercourse, there was this weird scientific battle that happened about if syphilis and gonorrhea were the same thing or if they were a different disease entirely. And I know this sounds crazy now, but at the time, there was no knowledge about what caused diseases. There was no germ theory. So, in a short summary, John Hunter, who decided that he was going to inoculate himself with just syphilis to prove that it wasn't gonorrhea. And then the person he inoculated himself with had both. So yeah, up until the 19th century, there was still so much confusion as to whether syphilis and gonorrhea were different manifestations of the same disease, largely driven by the fact that John Hunter was an incredibly renowned physician. Eventually, in 1838, Philippe Ricord, a physician and surgeon who worked under William de Poitrin, a French anatomist and military surgeon, firmly established that syphilis and gonorrhea were separate diseases and differentiated the three stages of syphilis and the primary lesions of syphilis as the canker, and that's why it's called Ricord's canker. By the early 18th century, syphilis had ceased to be a virulent epidemic disease and became more of the episodic disease it is today. From around the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, the incidence of syphilis in developed countries declined rapidly, except in times of war. During each of the world wars, the Korean War and the Vietnam War, the incidence of syphilis and STDs in general rose sharply, but only briefly. After 1943, and with the advent of penicillin and institution of public health measures, its incidence declined again. Although in the past decades, it has slowly begun to increase once more. And that's the general history of syphilis in an exceptionally brief way that doesn't lend to all the nitty-gritty details. On that note, let's go into the next segment, which honestly needs a really fun name, like Crazy Treatments or something wild like that, because people are fun and creative in the period before modern medicine. Here, we're going to cover all the wild ways syphilis has been treated throughout history. In the early 16th century, the main treatment for syphilis were guaiacum and mercury. The bark of the guaiacum tree, also known as the guaiac, Holywood, lignum sanctum, lignum vitae, and hicum, was a popular treatment due to its ability to induce sweating in those who consumed it. The guaiacum tree is native to the Caribbean and was probably introduced to Europe by the Spanish in the first decades after Columbus's first voyage. Guaiacum was conceptualized for medicinal use based on the theory of natural philosophy. Basically, natural philosophers would read the book of nature and accept occult or secret ways of knowing that now seem completely nonsensical to our modern scientific methods. But in short, at this time there was a theory of four humors. You might have heard of these before, but they include yellow bile, black bile, phlegm, and blood. And the idea in this theory of health and wellness is that if your humors are misbalanced, it results in sickness. So the idea was when you ingest guaiacum, it results in the body beginning to sweat, which releases excess water and therefore would rebalance the four humors. And that's how you could cure a patient. The original treatments that were found, though, in older documents, suggest that the original recipes were meant for the treatment of the French disease and other running open sores, which suggests that it was extremely nonspecific and was meant to cure many illnesses. So obviously, guaiacum was not effective as a cure, and the alternative was mercury. Paracelsus, the legend who is merited with bringing together chemistry and medicine, derided the use of guaiacum as useless and expensive and instead promoted mercury, metals being one of Pericles' favorite medicinal treatments for disease. And more specifically, Pericles is famous for pioneering the use of minerals such as mercury, lead, arsenic, and antimony to cure diseases. But even he recognized that it was ridiculous to prescribe for someone to drink mercury, because when it was administered as an elixir, it often resulted in the person dying. So, rather, he decided that it was better to use it as an ointment, and he generated these ointments made from metallic mercury, and they were meant to be rubbed onto the skin, or to be used as suffumigation, which is the inhalation of and bathing of the body in fumes, which literally means that people would take mercury saunas. Even at this time, many physicians doubted the efficacy of mercury, especially as it had terrible side effects and many patients died of mercury poisoning. But nonetheless, the treatment remained extremely popular far into the 17th century. In a description of the treatment by Beck, a patient undergoing the treatment was secluded in a hot, stuffy room and rubbed vigorously with the mercury ointment several times a day. The massaging was done near a hot fire, which the sufferer was then left next to in order to sweat. This process went on for a week to a month or more, and would later be repeated if the disease persisted. Other toxic substances such as vitriol and arsenic were also employed, but their curative effects were equally in doubt. As most of us know today, Simply from the way our mothers reacted when we broke a thermometer, mercury is a nasty heavy metal you do not want to ingest and has terrible side effects. These include neuropathies, kidney failure, and severe mouth ulcers and loss of teeth, and many patients died of mercurial poisoning rather than syphilis. Treatment would typically go on for years at end and gave rise to the saying, a night with Venus and a lifetime with mercury. As we entered the 20th century, little had changed, though, in the realm of the scientific understanding of syphilis until around 1905, when the first diagnostic test for syphilis was identified. This was a year that T. pallidum was both identified as the causative agent for syphilis,
oh no, you found me,
and associated with the illness by Fritz Richard Schaudin, a German zoologist, and Erich Hoffmann, a dermatologist. By 1906, August Paul von Wassermann, a German bacteriologist and an assistant to the Robert Koch of Koch's postulates, which I will definitely cover at one point in time, developed an antibody test for syphilis, the Wassermann reaction. So finally, there was a way to properly diagnose people using a more scientific measure than symptoms alone. But now that the cause had been identified, mercury was still the primary treatment, and this lasted until 1910. The only thing that stopped the use of this incredibly toxic substance was the discovery of Salvarsan in 1906 by Paul Ehrlich, a German histological chemist at the Robert Koch Institute, who later in his life founded the sciences of chemotherapy and immunology. So we're talking about a big name here. Ehrlich had been experimenting for some years with the use of arsenic compounds in treating trypanosomiasis, which over time led him to experiment with arsenic compounds to treat syphilis in rabbits. His experiments were not very successful, as most of the early arsenicals he experimented with were too toxic. But in 1909, he and his assistant, Saharichio Hata, a Japanese bacteriologist, finally found success with the compound dioxydiaminoarsenbenzyldihydrochloride, which they later called drug 606, that showed incredible effectiveness to eliminate syphilis in the host without causing severe effects, such as those observed when using mercury. And just to note, this host was a rabbit. Drug 606 was rebranded to Salvarsan and later was reformulated in 1912 to be Neo-Salvarsan. Salvarsan was Ehrlich's magic bullet, a theorized compound that would quickly and effectively eliminate the pathogen while having a limited effect on the host. To note, treatment for syphilis at the time of Salvarsan's discovery was routine injections with mercury for 2 to 4 years with very, very low cure rates. Comparably, this magic bullet was able to cure the illness permanently and became the primary treatment for syphilis until the discovery of penicillin and other novel antibiotics towards the middle of the 20th century. Therefore, the discovery of Salvarsan represents basically the birth of modern pharmacological research, one of the many reasons that it so quickly won Ehrlich a well-deserved Nobel Prize. Unfortunately, though, Salvarsan was not perfect. Salvarsan, although able to cure syphilis, whereas mercury wasn't, had many drawbacks. Unlike its use in rabbits, in people, administration of treatment was complex, requiring many injections over a long period of time, and it also produced many toxic effects. Over the next 40 years, various combinations of arsenicidal compounds with others were tested to try and improve the treatment methods, eventually identifying that for arsenic to be effective, it had to be combined with a small dose of either bismuth or mercury. Arsenic, mainly arsenophenamine, neoarsenophenamine, acetazone, and mafarizide, in combination with bismuth or mercury, then became the mainstay of treatment for syphilis until the advent of penicillin in 1943. Here we have to represent another very weird way that syphilis was treated that was discovered by the only psychiatrist to ever win a Nobel Prize, Julius Wagner Schreck of Austria. The physician noted that among his patients with neurosyphilis, after coming down with a strong fever, they would suddenly have many of their symptoms resolved. This observation led to the rationale that could inoculating a patient with malaria, allowing a fever to develop, and then curing the malaria with quinine be easier than using mercury or Salvarsan to treat the disease? And after some very questionably ethical studies where patients underwent this treatment labeled fever therapy when they were comatose,
questionable moral practices in medicine,
it was identified to be an actual cure for syphilis. And he won a Nobel Prize for this. And finally, in all the weird and frankly crazy treatments for syphilis, in 1943, one of the greatest medications in modern medicine and maybe in human history was discovered. Penicillin. Penicillin was introduced as a treatment for syphilis by John Mahoney, Richard Arnold, and A.D. Harris. Mahoney and his colleagues at the U.S. Marine Hospital in Staten Island treated 4 patients with primary syphilis cankers with intramuscular injections of penicillin every 4 hours for 80 days for a total of 1,200,000 units, by which time the syphilis had been cured.
Freedom!
This became a turning point in the treatment of syphilis, as penicillin was shown to be highly effective when administered during either its primary or secondary stages, and it had few side effects of any significance when compared to mercury or arsenic. Arnold wrote in 1986 of his early work with penicillin and syphilis, "Syphilis was once a dreaded and dreadful disease involving millions of U.S. citizens. Before the introduction of penicillin, the heavy metal cure often caused thousands of deaths each year. The morbidity and mortality of the disease itself was horrendous, involving all ages from the fetus to the elderly." And today, treatment hasn't largely changed. Syphilis is actually shockingly easy to treat, ever since the discovery of the golden liquor of life called antibiotics, with the cheap and affordable benzethine benzyl penicillin, proving to remain the most effective treatment. This is actually one of the reasons that this medication is on the WHO's essential medications list. Unfortunately, though, there has recently been shortages of this life-saving medication in many high syphilis morbidity countries since 2015. In 2016, in a paper titled "Estimating Benzethine Penicillin Need for the Treatment of Pregnant Women Diagnosed with Syphilis During Antenatal Care in High Morbidity Countries," published in PLOS ONE, it was estimated that if syphilis screening coverage was increased to greater than 95% coverage among all pregnant women in the 30 countries with the highest syphilis burden, an estimated 712,000 women would require treatment with at least one injection of penicillin. With all treatment, though, we always have to be scared of resistance developing. So, interesting fact, penicillin, literally one of the cheapest antibiotics in the world and the true OG of antibiotic therapy, seems to, for some reason, be completely fine to use even to this day on syphilis. While many other bacteria have quickly developed resistance, it seems as though Treponema pallidum isn't able to, which is actually quite shocking. Regardless of this, though, many doctors, looking at you, high-income nations, still choose to provide second-line oral antibiotics like macrolides or tetracyclines to treat early syphilis, and this, in the absence of its clinical need due to allergies or something similar to that, is extremely detrimental to the protection of our slowly waning lists of effective antibiotics. Because of this action, currently, there is actually quite a bit of macrolide resistance among Treponema pallidum in Australia, Canada, China, Europe, and the USA. Because I was kind of interested to know how common a penicillin allergy really is, because doctors do ask it to you every single time they provide you with penicillin to treat an infection, I found a review article that says, quote, "True penicillin allergy is rare, with the estimated frequency of anaphylaxis as 1 to 5 per 10,000 cases of penicillin therapy." Although this same paper says that hypersensitivities may be more common, but only 1 in 10 people who say they are allergic to penicillin truly are. Kind of a fun fact, eh? So now that we know the history and the treatments, let's touch onto, well, where is syphilis today? As you will assume from the history of syphilis, it quickly spread around the world following its first identification in 1495 and has been spreading ever since. As well, due to the presence of an effective and relatively cheap treatment, similarly to many diseases, its presence is inversely related to the country's GDP you're examining. Therefore, I'm going to immensely generalize this conversation to compare and contrast high-income countries to middle and lower-income countries. The distribution of syphilis in populations greatly differs depending on the nation of interest. Generally, in lower-income countries, there is a well-distributed population prevalence of the infectious disease, although data is greatly limited to prevalence among women during their first antenatal visits. Comparably, syphilis is greatly limited in high-income nations to concentrated epidemics among marginalized populations, including men who have sex with men, transgender women, and sex workers. It is important to note, though, that across the world, men who have sex with men, transgender women, and sex workers are disproportionately burdened with the disease. This has been attributed to these specific groups largely being ignored in targeted testing and treatment, unlike pregnant women at their first antenatal care visits, and therefore do not benefit from these programs to reduce syphilis in the population. As well, these populations often experience reduced access and acceptance in healthcare systems, and therefore do not receive appropriate care due to stigma and discrimination. One interesting tidbit on syphilis's epidemiology is that the infection is currently on the rise in many nations. Using the United States as an example, between 2000 to 2017, rates of primary and secondary syphilis have risen from 2 per 100,000 to approximately 10 per 100,000, an over 4 times increase. This rise has occurred disproportionately among men who have sex with men, with over half co-infected with HIV, which can increase the severity and transmissibility of the bacterial infection. There are many factors that are thought to lead to this higher rate of men who have sex with men. This can include traumatic sexual practices such as fisting and the rectum's high level of vascularization, which can increase the risk of transmission in the population. As well, due to common sexual selection practices such as serosorting, which is the active seeking of partners with an identical HIV status to oneself, unprotected sex is on the rise in this population due to the belief that unprotected anal intercourse is safer when practicing this behavior. Finally, men who have sex with men are more likely to participate in densely connected sexual networks and have subculture and social sexual norms, such as the use of bathhouses in San Francisco in the 1970s and 1980s, that may further inflate the number of sexual partners each individual has. So to finish this section, according to the Centers for Disease Control, in 2018, the rate of reported primary and secondary syphilis cases among men was 18.7 per 100,000 compared to 3 cases per 100,000 in females. Rates were highest among 25 to 29-year-olds, with the risk among men in this age group being 55.7 cases per 100,000 compared to only 9.4 cases per 100,000 in females in this same age group. So that means that the men were almost 5 times as likely as women to have syphilis. The highest rates were observed among all visible minorities compared to whites, with blacks having 4.7 times the rate when compared to Caucasians. Even more sadly, the rate of congenital syphilis continues to climb and has increased to 33.1 cases per 100,000 live births in 2018, representing a 40% increase compared to the previous year. This is one of the most disheartening statistics, as testing and treatment of women early in pregnancy has been shown to be an effective intervention to prevent negative outcomes, which is one of the many reasons why things such as Planned Parenthood are so important, for more reasons than being able to provide women abortions and access to birth control methods, but also because it allows women from lower income communities to have access to prenatal care and antenatal care and be able to have these tests to protect their children and protect themselves. On the note of prevention, let's take a stroll through effective methods to, you know, not catch syphilis and to prevent it in the community. And I know, you've heard this millions of times, but the number one prevention for any STD is to know your sexual partner and to help to normalize getting tested. In British Columbia, where I live, the recommendation is that you should get tested when you have a new sexual partner, your partner has a new sexual partner, you notice kinkers on or in your body, you had sex with someone who has an STI, or you had sex and the condom broke, which sounds like a lot of testing. Overall, though, getting tested should be something that is part of a regular activity and should be something that we normalize with our friends. And that's one of the biggest things. Normalizing testing, normalize using a condom, is one of the most effective ways to actually reduce most sexually transmitted diseases. Next up is syndromic management, which basically means if you see anything weird on your body, just going in to see a doctor, showing them and asking the question. If you can, always get unusual growths around your genitalia checked out by a doctor to ensure that you are keeping yourself and others safe. At a larger population scale, creating programs that increase access to point-of-care testing and treatment will also be essential to help reduce the prevalence in the general population. As syphilis is on the rise, mobile programs that promote testing and treatment in addition to faster partner notifications can help reduce the number of individuals who may be infected. Finally, as I said before, strategies that focus on preventing vertical transmission from mother to child will be essential to prevent the long-term morbidity and mortality that occurs through congenital syphilis. This can involve increasing access to prenatal care and improving uptake of these tests. And now we have to always ask, is there a vaccine? Can there be a vaccine? And unfortunately, while there has been many attempts to create a vaccine for syphilis, none yet have been effective to date. But syphilis is the only sexually transmitted infection that actually has compelling evidence that a vaccine could be created. Woo-hoo! In 1973, Dr. James Miller used an extended immunization regime on rabbits, and after 60 intravenous injections of gamma-irradiated T. pallidum over 37 weeks, followed by an intradermal challenge with the homologous T. pallidum strain, no infection developed. So, in simpler English, after 60 injections of dead syphilis that was killed using a method that didn't alter kind of the outside of the bacteria, the rabbit developed resistance, which is pretty cool. So this is thought to prove that it is essential to maintain the shape of the surface proteins and the lipid content of the cell wall to generate this long-term resistance. As well, a time-honored clinical and laboratory observation among humans and rabbits is that patients that have recovered from primary syphilis infections demonstrate something that's called canker immunity. And the same thing is observed in rabbits with healed cankers. How this works is that if an individual with syphilis is treated after the primary canker has healed, they can develop immunity. But interestingly, this doesn't occur if they're treated while they still have that initial syphilitic canker. So when we put all this information together, it seems like there's pretty good evidence that a vaccine could be developed. Except for one thing. As I mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, the only known host for T. pallidum is, well, humans. And it has proven to be exceptionally difficult to culture, a very fancy science word for saying to grow, these types of bacteria in laboratories. Actually, T. pallidum has almost exclusively been grown in animal models, having to be transferred from a human host into an animal host to be able to maintain the bacteria for an extended period of time. Although more recently, in 2018, a group identified a way to culture the bacteria in a medium, there was one big caveat. And this was perfectly described by the primary author of the paper, Diane Edmondson, PhD, that said, one of the reasons for success is accepting that we're never going to get very high density cultures. We work with what it really is. This once again creates the issue. There is no truly sustainable way to generate a high volume of live bacteria that can be irradiated and then integrated as an ingredient into the vaccine. As well, we don't have a way currently that we're able to copy what that lipid bilayer looks like. So for that reason, it doesn't seem like right now we would be able to develop one, although there has been a proof of concept which suggests it may be possible in the near future. And finally, if there isn't a vaccine, is there another like prophylactic strategy? So is there another strategy we can take that isn't using a condom, isn't having fewer sexual partners, isn't getting tested to actually protect ourselves from getting the disease? And so this is super cool. But there are currently some studies focused on identifying if taking doxycyclines, so this is an antibiotic in the tetracycline class, daily in individuals who are part of high-risk populations may help reduce the burden of syphilis in these groups. Similarly, other research teams have explored if doxycycline may be used as an effective post-exposure prophylaxis to consume after unprotected sex in hopes of reducing the risk of syphilis infection. The results of these studies have so far appeared positive, with significant reduction in the contraction of syphilis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea being observed. So, you might be asking, what exactly is pre-exposure versus post-exposure prophylaxis? And I think the best example is if you think about birth control. So pre-exposure prophylaxis means that you're doing something constantly to prevent it. So the equivalent for this would be a birth control pill. The woman takes it every single day, regardless of if she intends to have sex or not. In comparison, post-exposure prophylaxis would be the morning after pill. When something happens that you weren't expecting, you take that pill to help to protect you. It is prevention after the fact rather than it being something that's planned beforehand. So remember, pre-exposure is prevention all the time, and post-exposure is when you take it only as an emergency preventative measure. To this note, this might not be exactly perfect because now they're kind of working on potentially using pre-exposure only when you know you're going to do things, in contrast to taking it constantly, but that's just a small minute detail. But anyways, back to syphilis from this aside. As more data is collected, it will be interesting to see how this preventative practice is implemented and rolled out, specifically with concerns surrounding the potential for these treatments to increase antimicrobial resistance amongst other infections. Antimicrobial stewardship will be a key consideration. And that's it. That's the end of this week. In the end, syphilis is a complex and historically monumental disease. It led to the birth of ingenious and creative strategies to treat it, and has birthed controversy after controversy and innovation after innovation, truly changing the way that medicine is practiced today. I would like to say a huge thank you for sticking around for this long with me. Hope that you learned something new and had a good time doing it, and will join me again in the near future. If you want a little bit more of all of this, feel free to follow on all socials at InfectiousCast and send any suggestions at infectiouspodcast@gmail.com. As well, all show notes are going to be published on a personal blog that I'm currently working on as of May 1st, 2021. And that's going to be addynadine.com/infectious. So that's going to be addynadine.com/infectious. And if you enjoyed this, I'm happy you did. And if you want to support me, please leave a rating on Apple Podcasts to help others find it. Or even better, just share it with a friend. Finally, I want to say a big thanks to the following creators on freesound.com for the sound effects I used today. As always, thank you to Max Makes Sounds for our theme music, Wolf Singer 1489232, Captain Cuthbert and Scat the Cat, Higgs01, Tim Can, Do My Zick, Jackson Academy Ashore, Ant103010, and The Uncertain Man. And to reward you for sticking around so long through the credits, in an absolutely weird and not related fact whatsoever, dolphins fall asleep with one eye open and only turn off half their brain, which is pretty cool. This type of sleep is known as unihemisphere sleep, as only one brain hemisphere sleeps at a time, and is how they manage to, you know, not drown when they're taking a nap. Anyways, think about all the Netflix you could binge if you could just sleep with half your brain on and off. Anyways, I hope that you learned something new today and have an amazing week and an awesome day. Take care.